Okay, imagine this for a second. You're 19 years old. You get on a plane, maybe for the very first time, and you land in Finland.
Right.
And it's winter. So the sun barely comes up. It is dark. It's freezing. And the language is, well, it's famously one of the hardest on earth for an English speaker to learn.
It sounds like the setup for a survival thriller or
It
something.
really does. But you're not there just to survive. You're there to teach. You've got this message you believe in, but you literally don't have the words to say it. You're young, you're inexperienced, and you're, basically mute.
And that specific pressure cooker is exactly what we're looking at today.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are unpacking a really fascinating stack of personal memoirs, journals from missionaries who served in Finland. And look, even if you're not religious, you should stick with us.
Oh, definitely.
Because what we found in these documents from people like Ferrell Sorensen, Bruce Kalji, that's Skull Jai and Scott Anderson, it's not really a theology lesson.
No, it's more like a study in human resilience. These are stories about what happens when you're stripped of your natural abilities, your ability to speak, to connect, to even know what's going on around
Yes,
you.
you have to rely on something else.
Exactly. And that something else is kind of the core of our mission today.
We're going to explore how these young people navigated, just extreme incompetence, the comedy that comes from these cultural clashes, and this concept they keep bringing up called enabling power.
Which is really just a fancy way of asking, what do you do when you hit your absolute limit?
So let's set the scene. We're talking about cities like Oulu, that's Ohuulu,
Yeah.
and Pietarsaari, Peea Tarsaari. And the very first thing that just screams from these journals is the panic about the Finnish language.
It is palpable. And just for context, Finnish isn't like learning Spanish or French. It's not an Indo-European language. It has, what, 15 noun cases? It's a fortress.
A fortress. I like that. And usually the missionary program has a system for this, right? You're paired up, you have a senior companion who's been there a year, knows the ropes.
And a junior companion, the rookie.
The senior is supposed to do the heavy lifting while the junior learns.
It's an apprenticeship model. It's safe, it's structured.
But for Ferrell Sorensen, that system just, it completely broke down.
Oh, completely. Sorensen had been in Finland for exactly 2 months. I mean, that's barely enough time to learn how to buy groceries, let alone teach complex ideas.
And then, because of staffing needs, he gets sent to Oulu to be companions with a guy named Veli Rasmussen.
And here's the kicker.
How long had Rasmussen been there?
2 months.
Exactly. It's the blind leading the blind. They're supposed to be senior companions to each other, but neither of them can actually speak Finnish. Sorensen writes that they were basically teaching each other the language on the fly, hour by hour.
Can you just imagine that stress? You're knocking on doors, representing your entire faith, trying to explain metaphysics, and you probably can't even ask where the bathroom is correctly.
And that pressure, it seems to create this really interesting psychological or, spiritual phenomena. Sorensen describes a moment where they're teaching a woman who is genuinely
Oh,
interested.
the stakes are high.
Extremely high. They're tag-teaming the lesson, just splitting topics to survive the mental fatigue. Rasmussen is teaching, and he hits a wall.
Gets lost in the grammar. Now, they had a system for this. If one of them got stuck, they had this physical signal.
Touching their tie.
Right, that was the SOS. I'm drowning, save me.
So Rasmussen touches his tie. He's done. But Sorensen admits in his journal, I was already lost from the beginning.
He wasn't even following the conversation.
Not at all. He didn't know what the question was. He didn't know where Rasmussen left off. But he sees the signal. He knows he has to say something.
And this is where it gets wild.
Because he has zero comprehension. But he opens his mouth. And he describes it almost like a glitch in reality. He says an answer just came out.
He didn't construct it.
No. He says it was, quote, obviously from the spirit. He repeats this answer that just flowed through him. It perfectly satisfies the woman's question, and they move on.
It's like an extreme flow state or something.
Yeah. And Sorensen says on the bike ride home, Rasmussen asked him, how did you know to say that? And Sorensen had to admit, I didn't. Neither of them felt like they mentally constructed the sentences.
And that's not an isolated incident in these files either. We've got a really similar account from Jay Wiseman in Pietarsaari.
Is maybe even more dissociative.
Yes. Wiseman is with a visiting leader, Veli Rinne, that's Rinne, Rin's an expert. He knows the language. They knock on a door. A woman answers and asks this very calm, specific question.
Like she'd been waiting for them.
And Wiseman admits he did not have the vocabulary to answer. He's just standing there, probably waiting for Rin to take over.
But he doesn't wait. He says, and this is a quote, "I was astonished by what my body was doing without my involvement."
Without my involvement.
Uh-huh.
That is a trippy way to describe speaking. It is. He spoke fluent, perfect Finnish. The visiting leader, Rin, was just shocked. He asks Wiseman afterward, "How did you learn to speak like that?"
And does Wiseman say, "I didn't."
It's like his conscious brain was just bypassed. Which brings us to that key term we mentioned, enabling power.
Right.
One of the other missionaries, Burke Rees, he kind of frames this philosophically. He argues that this isn't just, you know, a magic trick.
How does he define it?
Well, Rees describes being terrified, assigned to teach a couple despite having inadequate speech. But he talks about the difference between capability and reliance.
Okay, unpack that a little.
He says that when his own physical comprehension failed, when his brain couldn't process the Finnish, he felt a still small voice translating the feelings of the people he was talking to.
So not the words, but the intent behind them.
Exactly. He was operating on spiritual intuition. And even more practically, he says that when he couldn't form the sentences to answer, he would remember scriptures he'd memorized years before. He couldn't translate the concept himself, but he could point to the text that could.
So he was using tools he had already stored up.
Right. And Rees's whole argument is that this enabling power is the bridge. And it only kicks in when you step into that darkness of incompetence. If you stay in your comfort zone where you're already capable, you never trigger it.
That's a powerful idea. You have to be over your head for the help to arrive.
Precisely. If you can do it yourself, you don't need it.
Although I have to say, sometimes that help shows up in ways that are just funny. We have to talk about Scott Anderson. He wasn't looking for a glitch in the Matrix. He just wanted to stop embarrassing himself.
Ah, the Eastern dialect story. This one's a classic.
It is. Anderson is struggling, so he prays specifically for help with the language. He wants the gift of tongues.
A valid request in that line of work.
Totally. And the next day, he feels it. He's on fire. He's speaking so fast, so fluently, that an investigator, a local guy, actually stops him. He gets suspicious.
He accuses him of being a native.
But not just any native. The guy says, "You speak terrible Finnish for a native."
That's the punchline.
He thought Anderson was from the east side of Finland, like the boonies, and was just faking being an American to seem interesting.
Which, I mean, given how hard Finnish is for Americans, is maybe the highest compliment you could possibly get. You don't sound like a tourist, you sound like a hillbilly.
I'd take it. I'm not incompetent, I'm just rustic. I love it.
It shows fluency comes in all sorts of forms.
It does. But okay, so language is the obvious barrier. But these journals show that words weren't the only way to bridge that gap. There's a fantastic story from Bruce Scolgi about, you know, the universal language.
Music.
Music.
This is one of my favorite anecdotes in the whole stack because it's all about breaking stereotypes. Scolgi is in Ulu, and he's on an exchange with a missionary named Veli Sligowski.
And you have to paint a picture of Sligowski for us because he's not what you'd expect.
Not at all. Scolgi calls him the opposite of a stereotypical piano-playing missionary. This is a guy who drives fast cars, he builds houses, he raises gardens. He's a rugged, hands-on type.
Right. Scolgi explicitly says he is not a piano player, he's a builder.
So they go visit a contact who happens to be a school music teacher.
A tough audience.
A very tough audience. They walk in, and there's an upright Finnish piano against the wall.
And this is where it gets good. Sligowski, the car guy, the builder, sits down at the keys, and Scolgi is probably thinking, oh no, this is going to be chopsticks.
But Sligowski starts playing Bridge Over Troubled Water.
And he's good.
Scolgi calls him Art Garfunkel in disguise. He says he played with incredible sensitivity, incredible virtuosity. The music teacher is just, he's floored.
But then there's a problem, a cultural snag. The teacher loves the music, but he's conflicted.
Right. He asks, doesn't your church teach that this kind of music is sin?
Wait, why would he think Simon and Garfunkel is a sin?
Well, this is a fascinating moment of cultural collision. You have to remember the local context. This teacher had probably been influenced by a more strict religious tradition that viewed any sort of secular enjoyment, pop music, dancing, as incompatible with holiness.
So he's been suppressing his own musical talent because he thinks God hates it.
That seems to be it. He thinks you have to choose. Be religious or be a musician.
And Shaw's response is just brilliant. He doesn't give some big theological lecture. He cracks a joke.
He says, "If I played the piano, it would be sinful."
But when Slagowski plays, it's beautiful.
It totally reframes the issue. And Shalja reflects later that God doesn't ask us to diminish our gifts. He asks us to consecrate them.
That's a beautiful distinction.
It is. You don't stop being a musician to be a believer. You bring the music with you. And the source says the teacher joined the church and eventually became the music director for that congregation.
That's really cool. So it wasn't just about them bringing something to fill in. It was about unlocking what was already there.
Exactly.
I do want to pivot here, though. We've talked about these magical language skills, poignant musical connections, mm-hmm. but we have to be real. Not every interaction was that poetic. Sometimes it was just pure, unadulterated awkwardness.
You are, I take it, referring to the incident in the restaurant.
I'm referring to The Birth of a Book. This story from Scott Anderson had me laughing out loud.
It's a classic case of good intentions gone wrong. So the setting is midsummer,
which in Finland is a huge deal. The sun is up almost all night.
And the locals are celebrating heavily.
By which we mean drinking.
A lot of drinking. So the missionaries are out at a restaurant, and they're sitting next to a man who is, let's say, extremely festive.
He's drunk.
Yeah.
But Anderson's companion looks at this guy and thinks, this is a golden contact.
Optimistic people. Missionaries.
So he wants to give the man a Book of Mormon. But you have to explain the logistics here because this is what causes the whole problem.
Right. So in this era, to keep a professional look, they sometimes wore this special harness under their suit coats. It was a strap system to carry a paperback book concealed against their chest.
Like a shoulder holster, but for scripture.
Exactly. So now picture this from the drunk man's perspective. This American in a dark suit turns to him, reaches deep inside his own coat, and starts wrestling with something near his ribs.
And then he pulls out a book.
And the man's reaction is just priceless. He jumps back, points a shaky finger, and screams for the whole restaurant to hear. He just gave birth to a book.
He gave birth to a book? Can you imagine the scene?
It's a PR nightmare. Anderson says everyone in the restaurant just stopped eating and stared.
I bet they finished their meal pretty quickly after that.
Very quickly. But I think it's important those stories are in there. It highlights the human comedy of it all. You're trying so hard to be the spiritual messenger, and sometimes reality just slaps you in the face with a drunk guy yelling about book birth.
It really grounds the whole narrative. But amid the comedy, the journals also touch on some really deep personal relationships with the locals.
Yes, Scott Anderson's writings in particular are full of these character studies. You can feel how much they loved the people.
Like Sister Haimo.
The surrogate grandmother. She's in her 80s. She'd feed them, knit them socks, which Anderson says he still has, by the way.
But she wasn't just coddling them.
No, she corrected their grammar. He'd write out his talk for church, and she would take a red pen to it.
That is true love. Here's a meatball, and also, that verb conjugation was wrong.
It's a partnership. But then you have these tragic figures, too. The story of Sister Tynan, that's T-I-N-N. That one really stood out to me.
This one was heavy.
It was. Sister Tynan was a woman in a wheelchair. She believed the message. She wanted to be baptized. But she was completely dependent on her daughter.
And the daughter was not on board.
No. The daughter had been told by a local priest that the missionaries were a cult, and she refused to help.
So this woman is in an impossible position. She physically cannot get herself to the water.
And Anderson notes that, as far as he heard, she never was baptized. It's a heartbreaking reminder that conversion isn't just an intellectual choice. It's wrapped up in family and fear and physical limitations.
It shows that enabling power we talked about doesn't just magically fix everything.
Absolutely not. And dealing with those hard realities, that rejection, that failure, that is what forces these missionaries to grow up.
Yeah, let's talk about that growth.
Mm.
Vern Bodin has this great entry about his conviction being solidified, not during a spiritual high, but during an argument.
The trial by fire. He's at a door. A woman challenges him aggressively. He tells her he knows these things are true, and she just shuts him down. She says, "There's no way you can know that."
Which is a direct shot at his integrity. She's calling him a liar.
Or deluded, at least. And for a lot of people, that could plant a seed of doubt. But for Bodin, it was the opposite. He said that challenge triggered something deep in his gut. He realized, actually, I do know. I know this better than anything.
The resistance strengthened the muscle.
Exactly. You don't know how strong your conviction is until someone tries to break it.
And speaking of strengthening, we have to mention the visit of their church president, Spencer W. Kimball, to Oulu.
That was a massive event for them. To these missionaries, he isn't just a CEO, he's a prophet of God. So having him come to the tiny corner of Finland was huge.
They wrote about shaking his hand. But what struck me was the advice he gave them.
Yes. It wasn't some grand theological statement. It was very practical, almost paternal advice. He told them, don't delay marriage, don't delay school, don't delay work.
Life advice.
He was looking at their whole lives, telling them, do a good job here, but then go home and build a life.
And I love the souvenir they gave him.
The reindeer skin, a beautiful reindeer skin signed on the back by every single missionary.
It just anchors the story in that specific place. You don't get a signed reindeer skin in Brazil or Japan. Mm-hmm. It's a piece of Finland.
It is. And speaking of the specific culture of mission life, we have to mention the Haddon Cup Award before we wrap up.
This cracked me up. The gamification of missionary work.
Right. Paul Sharman and Veli Rasmussen won an award for the best companionship in their city.
It shows they're still competitive young men. They wanted to win the prize.
But Sharman makes a really poignant point. He says they won the Haddon Cup for working hard tracking hours, teaching lessons, but for a long time they saw no fruit, no baptisms.
And that's the grind. It separates the effort from the outcome. You could do everything right, win the award, and still get zero results in the short term.
It requires a lot of patience and trusting that the effort matters even when the scoreboard is blank.
So when we look at this whole tapestry, from, you know, linguistic miracles to the book birth to the reindeer skins, what's the deep dive takeaway?
I think it goes right back to that concept we started with, enabling power. These sources show us a group of young people stepping into a world they were completely unqualified for. They didn't know the language, the culture. Half the time, they didn't know what they were doing.
But they did it anyway.
And because they stepped into that incompetence, they found capacities they didn't know they had. Whether you want to call it God or the spirit or just a survival instinct kicking in, the lesson is that we are capable of so much more than we think.
But only if we're willing to let go of the safety of being competent.
Right. The power only kicks in after you open your mouth. You have to touch the tie signal and start talking before the words come.
So here's the question we want to leave you with today. Think about your own life, your job, your relationships. If you were faced with a situation where you had absolutely zero competence, where you were the blind leading the blind, would you trust that some kind of enabling power would show up?
Or would you freeze?
Because according to these journals, freezing is the only way to guarantee nothing happens. Even if something happening means accidentally speaking fluent Finnish or getting yelled at by a drunk guy, it's all part of the growth.
It certainly is.
Thanks for checking your sources with us today on The Deep Dive. We'll catch you on the next one.